Ani, and welcome to Bombsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. In this episode of Bombsida, we're going to hear the voices of women.
They did an assessment on us, right? And Jeremy falls under the institutional, under the category of being an institutionalized child. And cap is $2,200 a month, right? So told me if I lift off the reserve, and the total cap is $2,200 a month. But over that, a Jeremy requires more than $22,000, maybe about $4,000 more a month. So they said that over that, they have to institutionalize them. And I said, well, no, over my dead body. But anyways, it's the financial barrier that we're having problems
with. We affirm our commitment to activity, working towards complete protection of, respect for, and fulfillment of Canada's Indigenous Peoples Collective, their individual and collective human rights, and acceptance and affirmation of their cultural identity and their declared right of self-determination. So it goes on.
I started this journey. My niece went missing from the Highway of Tears in September 2005, and after compiling information and while I was searching for her, I realized that there was many other women that were going missing and being murdered across the country, and it appeared to myself and my co-founder, whom I met shortly after Tamara went missing, Bernie Williams.
I thought it was an appropriate time to remember her and especially remember the struggle that her sisters and her daughters have had over 35 years to tell her story and bring her justice. And that's what we're talking about tonight and what that has to do with other issues that we're facing as women today. Some of the women, other than Annie May, that are close to home here, like Nora Bernard, who led the largest class action.
All our lakes and rivers have to start getting back their identity, just the way we are as Anishinaabe people. We're seeking our identity, and I'm trying to tell the Union of Ontario Indies, the waters do have to search their identity so they can know what they're doing. They know which way they're supposed to go. They know what they're supposed to do.
We've heard the voices of those women in earlier episodes of Bombsida, but I wanted to put them together in one program to show how the voices of women can be heard, are being heard, and show the powerful work they've been doing to bring awareness to important issues like missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada, water quality, helping each other, and fighting for children and rights. And Aboriginal women's trio Osini will be in Bombsida's Music Spotlight this weekend. We'll get to all these stories plus great tunes from Osini right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. Grandfather Elder William Kamanda has passed away. The respected and well-known Algonquin elder was from Kitanzebia Anishinaabeg in Quebec. Grandfather was a keeper of several Algonquin wampum belts and keeper of the traditional prophecies and oral histories of his nation. He served as chief of Kitanzebia for over 19 years. Grandfather Kamanda was an advocate for Indigenous rights and had gained international status. He was asked to bless the Human Rights Monument with the Dalai Lama in 1990 and 8 years later presented Nelson Mandela with an eagle feather on behalf of First Nations people. Grandfather Kamanda also received many awards and accolades for his work throughout the decades. He died in the early morning of August 3rd at the age of 97 in his home on Kitanzebia Anishinaabeg. The funeral was held August 5th. RCMP in Manitoba are searching for the person or persons who decapitated a woman and left her remains on opposite sides of the road. Community members in Sandy Bay First Nation are reeling after the gruesome death, which happened over last weekend. The victim is 32-year-old Roberta McIver, mother of a 14-year-old girl. The Canadian Press reports the victim was well-liked in her community and was about to be trained as a healthcare worker. Pegwa's First Nation seems to have been left out of flood emergency funding. The First Perspective reports the Manitoba and federal governments are building a $100 million channel to drain water from Lake Manitoba by fall. But Pegwa's is still waiting for promised flood emergency funding from the federal government. Chief Glenn Hudson says in Pegwa's, it's actual homes that are destroyed by repeated flooding, not cottages. The chief says the $8.5 million in funding to replace and make repairs was supposed to flow in by July, but they're still waiting. There are still about 100 people that remain evacuated from their homes in Pegwa's. The annual caribou hunt in Labrador has been delayed. The Newfoundland and Labrador government delayed the hunt because of dwindling caribou numbers. The QMI agency reports the numbers are going down despite a number of hunting restrictions last year. The George River caribou herd has dropped 81%. The population currently numbers around 74,000, which is down from 385,000 10 years ago. The province is set to spend $1.9 million for a three-year study to find out what's affecting the caribou population. The remains of 13 Inuit are going to be returned to Rose Island in northern Labrador. The Telegram reports the remains were taken four decades ago, along with associated artifacts from stone burials during a Memorial University research project. During the excavation in the 70s, 113 Inuit remains were dug up and taken, but most were returned in 1995. The 13 remaining had been part of a collection at the Rooms Museum in St. John's. A repatriation ceremony will be held August 16th. There are more Aboriginal children in the care of Children's Aid than there was during the 60s scoop. It's being called the Millennium Scoop by John Bokash. The former leader of the Anishinaabeg Nation was hired by the Ontario government to look into child welfare. Bokash recently released his report. His report included 15 recommendations. A few of the top recommendations include improving short-term best practice policies, create cultural relevant programming, and establish a province-wide task force to serve urban Aboriginal children. To view the whole report, go to the Anishinaabeg Nation's website. A chief in BC says the Missing Women Inquiry is not welcome in her community. Saka's First Nation Chief Jackie Thomas told the Toronto Star that she doesn't believe the commission isn't a meaningful exercise. Thomas says she has serious doubts about the inquiry being led by Wally Opal, a former BC Appeal Court judge and attorney general. The Star reports she is the latest to speak against the inquiry after several groups have announced they would not participate because the government refuses to pay their legal bills. The commission's mandate is to examine serial killer Robert Picton's case and hold a less formal study into the broader issues of missing and murdered women. Indian Country Today reports Rosa River First Nation has received $80 million in compensation for a 1903 land grab. In 1903, the Canadian government forced the band to open up 7,700 acres of its reserve for farmers and settlers, so the band lost 60% of its land. As part of the settlement, each of the band's 1,500 adult members have received $5,000. Funds for miners will go into trust accounts. The remaining $61.6 million goes into a community endowment fund, with the interest going towards public band projects. Chief Terrence Nelson told the Winnipeg Free Press that one of the first issues to be addressed will be housing. Anishinaabe Nation Grand Chief Stan Beardy is pushing the governments of Ontario and Canada for funding for fire evacuees. Beardy says immediate support is required to replace the loss of at least one family home on Sandy Lake First Nation. He says families are coming home to nothing and the community doesn't have the resources to replace what they lost. Families have had to restock fridges and freezers due to power outages. Evacuees had been out of their homes for 2 weeks. According to the Chronicle Journal, about 3,600 Anishinaabe Nation residents were evacuated from their homes due to wildfires in northwestern Ontario. The Suquamish tribe in California has legalized gay marriage. The National Post reports a law was proposed by a young lesbian member 2 years ago. The law was passed unanimously by the tribal council. Suquamish tribal lawyer Michelle Hansen says the issue wasn't something controversial among the tribe. The Suquamish tribe is the second Native American group to legalize gay marriage. Melbourne will be the first city to fly the Aboriginal flag in Australia. The Herald Sun reports city councillors recently endorsed a three-year plan to fly the flag at the town hall to recognize the First People. The Aboriginal flag will fly alongside the Australian, Victorian, and Melbourne flags. The council also decided to drop the term Indigenous when referring to Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders. And that's your National Aboriginal News. was Maskwa's journey from Ossiney's first album, Rattle and Drum. We first met Maria Beadle in mid-July. With the help of her community, the mom is trying to access Jordan's principal to keep her 16-year-old son Jeremy from being institutionalized. Jeremy lives with hydrocephalus, otherwise known as water on the brain, cerebral palsy, and autism. Marina herself suffered a stroke last year and needed extra home care for both herself and her son. The cost of the extra care, however, is placing a burden on her community's budget. Marina and Jeremy live in Pictou Landing, First Nation, Nova Scotia.
Well, they did an assessment on us, right? And Jeremy falls under the under the category of being an institutionalized child. And cap is $2,200 a month, right? So they told me if I lift off the reserve, and the total cap is $2,200 a month. But over that, Jeremy requires more than $22,000, maybe about $4,000 more a month. So they said that over that, they have to institutionalize him. And I said, well, no, over my dead body. But anyways, it's the financial barrier that we're having problems with, like getting funds from someplace. So when the Jordan principal came in, then I watched it on at the tail end of it on APTN. And I said, I'm fighting that. And then sure enough, when we became candidates for the Jordan principal, and I said, I'm fighting it to the bitter end. I don't care. I said, even if Jeremy and I don't benefit from it, but other women will that are having a hard, same kind of problem that I am having and getting funds and stuff like that for their children. So they wouldn't have to struggle the way I have, going from one place to another just to try to get funding.
Tell me what a typical day is like for you and Jeremy.
Before I took the stroke?
Yeah, before and after. Tell me everything.
I took the stroke. Jeremy and I were always on the go. Either we'd be at the beach or someplace or on the powwow trail. You know what the powwow trail is, eh?
Mm-hmm. I do know what the powwow trail is.
Okay, so anyways, we would go on the powwow trail in the summer. And, like, you know, Thursday, we'd eat Thursday, then stay until Sunday or Monday. Then come home just for that 2 days and then leave again to Thursday just to come home and do laundry and whatnot and go somewhere else and go to a powwow or either spend time at the beach doing, that's where Jeremy got all started from was the beach, like from the time we tried to get him to set up on his own.
Mm-hmm.
And the beach was where we got him to, where I got him to start to sit up on his own. And all the therapies today, physiotherapy, occupational therapy, you know, started at beach each year. It was a long process, but it was well worth it too.
Mm.
And that was basically what we did during our days sometimes. But now that I'm home, we spend more time at home after the stroke.
Mm-hmm.
I have workers that come in that care for Jeremy so that I don't have to do it on my own anymore. And whenever we can go out for a cruise, we go out for a cruise, which isn't too often because the weather hasn't been too good to us this year, but now it's too extremely hot. And our days are usually filled with, like, being busy with Jeremy and getting him fed. And first he takes a shower, feeding him, dressing him up, changing his pamper, all the other things that we have to do with him.
Mm-hmm. If Jeremy were to be institutionalized, where would he end up, and would you happen to know the cost of that?
The cost of it would cost per day $350 per day, and it wouldn't be in the province of Nova Scotia. It would be out of the province. The only place that they would have an institution for the age barrier for Jeremy.
That was Marina Beadle of Pictou Landing First Nation. The community has taken the federal government to court trying to access Jordan's principal to get more help. Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development declined to comment because the issues are going before the court. This is a special episode of Bombsida focusing on the voices of women. Gladys Rick has been a guest on Bombsida a couple of times over the past year. She's been organizing the Walk for Justice. It's a walk to bring awareness to missing and murdered Aboriginal women. Here's an interview with her from the weekend of July 8th while she was in the middle of the fourth Walk for Justice and the women were calling for a national public inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada.
We left Vancouver on June 21st, National Aboriginal Day, from Vancouver to walk to Ottawa to raise awareness about the missing and murdered women. At the present time, today is Wednesday, July 6th. We are in Edson, and we are heading towards Enwistle for the day and working our way towards Edmonton.
Okay, and when are you hoping to arrive in Ottawa?
We will be arriving in Ottawa on September 17th, 2008, and we are holding a rally on Parliament Hill on September 19th, 2008.
Do you mean 2011?
Oh, sorry, yes, 2011, sorry. Yeah.
We have a time machine. So Gladys, how did this walk begin?
I started this this journey. My niece went missing from the Highway of Tears in September 2005, and after compiling information and while I was searching for her, I realized that there was many other women that were going missing and being murdered across the country, and it appeared to myself and my co-founder, whom I met shortly after Tamara went missing, Bernie Williams. We started compiling information in a database of over 4,000 missing and murdered women across Canada. My co-founder, Bernie Williams, also lost her mother and two sisters in the downtown east side of Vancouver to acts of violence over the years. And she is a frontline worker in the Canada's poorest postal code, Vancouver's downtown east side. And together we went on a mission because we wanted to raise awareness about the far too many missing and murdered women. And we decided that we wanted to be carry a voice for the families to demand accountability on from the governments about what was going on with these women going missing and being murdered. And together we just went on a mission to raise awareness from community to community. We attended the Highway of Tears walk from Prince Rupert to Prince George in 2006, and that's where the template was set on how to organize a walk nationally. And together, Bernie and I have been just working really hard for the families. We've met family members across the nation. We've made, you know, and we've tried to create that voice so that we can start bringing more attention to what's been going on with our women, and we feel that there needs to be an awareness campaign to address all the issues around far too many missing and murdered women. There's lots of issues that the government is responsible for putting public safety measures in, and there's a high rates of domestic violence that where nobody's addressing these issues, and we need to bring these issues to the forefront, and basically tell the Prime Minister that us women are to be respected, loved, and valued just as much as anybody else in this case, and murdered women.
So how do you feel awareness has grown in the 3 years that you've been doing this walk, or since 2008?
Well, I think that, as I say, it started out with the two co-founders, myself and Bernie Williams, who were missing a couple of, and had a couple of family members that were murdered, and now we've raised awareness nationally. We have hundreds of family members and tons of people that are now aware in each community that we've hit. There's been lots of awareness, and I believe that had Walk for Justice not walked across Canada the first time, even in BC, we have managed to successfully put the idea in there that there is need for a national public inquiry. And this national public inquiry is what we're going to be pushing for this year, because the one that's happening in Vancouver right now is kind of messed up. They've kind of made it into a Wally Opal thing. When Wally Opal, who was the Attorney General at one time, or Solicitor General in BC at one time, said back then that there was no need for a public inquiry, that it would have been a waste of money. When we think about public inquiry, we think about accountability and what went wrong, especially with the Robert Picton trial, and that's what this public inquiry in D.C. is supposed to be based on. But now Wally Opal is trying to combine everything and the Highway of Tears and the rest of the women in BC, well, we feel that considering the fact that he said that there was no need for this public inquiry and that it was going to cost too much money, now it's he's kind of changed his tune. Now he's getting $1,500 a day for this public inquiry. So the only one that's winning on this is the Canadian government and Wally Opal. And we're definitely against that because we feel that none of our issues are being dealt with, because the majority of the women that are going missing and being murdered are First Nations. So we feel that this is a war against our First Nations women. We also speak for the other, you know, like the other ethnic races and groups, because nobody else is doing that. We're a grassroots organization and we don't get paid for what we do. We run strictly on donation and volunteer. Every one of our walkers does not get paid for what we're doing. We're doing this because we care about what's happening with our women.
That was Gladys Raddick on the Walk for Justice and call for a national public inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada. Ossini is in Bombsida's Music Spotlight this weekend. Here's another cut from their first album. It's Esquises.
Esquises, you ask me why. I don't know the answer of why women die. Esquises, you ask me why the women who suffer and stifle their cries. Should we ignore their pain and to be fought advancing? Grant us the strength to resist and survive. Sing out ya ha, hey ya, wa hey yo. Oh, bring us the wisdom to staying alive. Hey yo, hey yo, hey yo, hey yo.
Esquises, oh, how you've grown, found you a lover to call.
The National Council of Women of Canada has signed a living declaration with the Native Women's Association of Canada and the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs to call for a national task force to address missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada. Mary Scott is the former president of the National Council of Women of Canada, and we first spoke with her in early June.
It is a joint declaration, and the process for the development of this declaration came about as a community process. Took several months to develop the language and in a very respectful way of looking at, for example, the National Council of Women of Canada, our policies that were particularly looking at violence against women, some of the international issues that we have spoken out about before, where there has been a decision on CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, that has looked at this issue. So there were a number of things that our National Council have been concerned about. And we then worked with the Native Women's Association of Canada and the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs to come up with a joint declaration that would express the voices of the organizations, the Aboriginal women's voices, and respect the policy and some of the things that we have been involved with as well. And so we set up the joint declaration, and we were very, very surprised and pleased that when we brought it forward, everyone in the room, and we had close to 100 people that signed on, and really it's a statement. It's a statement that says that we bear witness to the critical, tragic, and inequitable issue of the missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls, not just in Manitoba, but across Canada. We affirm our commitment to activity, working towards complete protection of, respect for, and fulfillment of Canada's Indigenous Peoples Collective, their individual and collective human rights, and acceptance and affirmation of their cultural identity and their declared right of self-determination. So it goes on, Jennifer, with that kind of language, and I think it's a very powerful document.
You say it's a powerful document, and in what way, and how will that declaration help move issues forward and keep the issue in the spotlight of murdered and missing Aboriginal women in the country?
I think, first of all, it is the declaration itself. It's the fact that the three organizations, plus many others, like I heard from the Business and Professional Women today, an organization that is actually a member of the National Council, they want to sign on. It's increasing awareness. It's women standing together, and men, but it's women saying, listen, we don't like what we see. Our governments have to do more. And for example, we've declared in this that we'll support, the National Council of Women will support the second annual Walk for Justice for Murdered and Missing Women, which is in Aboriginal Day, June 21st, and encourage others to support the walk as it moves across Canada. So it's not just an Aboriginal issue, an Aboriginal women's issue. It's our country's issue. And that's what we're saying. And so until the broader community takes a hold of this and realizes the facts, number one, and the fact also that Canada is not in compliance with the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination, and has asked Canada to report back on the steps that they are taking to address inadequate social assistance rates, failure of law enforcement agencies to deal with the disappearance and murder of Aboriginal women and girls. So you can see I feel quite strongly about it.
That was Mary Scott, former president of the National Council of Women of Canada. This BOMCEDAW special is about women's voices and women we've spoke with in past issues of the program. Kathy Martin is a filmmaker in Mi'kmaq territory on the East Coast. We spoke with her at the beginning of April about a talk she was about to do on strong Mi'kmaq women. Here she is.
I was invited to do a lecture on
whatever I wanted. And one of my favorite subjects is strong Mi'kmaq women in our history, and the women that I've known or I'm related to, who've inspired me because of the stories and because of the lives they've led. So tonight I get to talk about some of them and honor them by telling some of their stories over time. Some of them are my own relatives, my great-grandmothers, who were women trappers and hunters, and I'm going to be talking about, you know, the legacy and the life they had to lead, and with all of the injustices that they had to experience over time due to, you know, colonization and other things. So I'm going to get to talk a little bit about some of those women. There's many of them, and I'll bring it to the modern-day women that I've known, and one of them who has inspired me, I didn't know her personally, but I've gotten to know her through her family, is Annie Mae Aquash, Annie Mae Picto Aquash, who was a member of the Mi'kmaq community and was from Shubenacadie, Nova Scotia. She joined the American Indian Movement and was murdered in 1975, and it took 35 years for her daughters and her sisters to find justice for Annie Mae and to find the truth about who killed her. So in December, we attended the final trial of John Graham. Two men have been convicted and sentenced to life in prison for the murder, two Aboriginal men, and they were members of the American Indian Movement. So I'm going to talk about Annie Mae and focus on her as more than anything tonight. Her birthday is March 27th, and it's Women's History Month. And so I thought it was an appropriate time to remember her and especially remember the struggle that her sisters and her daughters have had over 35 years to tell her story and bring her justice. And that's what we're talking about tonight, and what that has to do with other issues that we're facing as women today. Some of the women other than Annie Mae that are close to home here, like Nora Bernard, who led the largest class action suit in the country for the residential school survivors, was a member of my band, and she was violently murdered a few years ago. Another young woman from my own reserve, Millbrook, Tanya Brooks, was murdered within the last year and a half. And both Tanya's case has yet to be solved. So she becomes a member of the unfortunate group of missing women in this country, murdered and missing women. She's not missing. I wanted to sort of bring the talk to what we can do today and to honor people like Annie Mae, like Nora Bernard, who have given their lives for a reason. I mean, they fought for justice. They saw injustices, and they worked with to change that, and unfortunately met some of them had to give their lives for that. So tonight, that's what I get to talk about. How's that?
That's fantastic. I wish I could be there. Yeah. And when you were talking about, you know, some of the violent ends that women have come to, and then you said we'll talk about what we can do today, and what can we do today?
Well, I've been very much part of the Sisters in Spirit campaign and struggle, and have participated since the campaign came to fruition, when the government provided funding to Native Women of Canada to raise awareness about the 500 plus missing women and murdered and missing women in this country, Aboriginal women. Unfortunately, this past year we received word that the funding be cut from this program, and I don't think 5 years is enough time to support the work of people who are trying to bring the voices of those murdered and missing women and their families to a place where we can understand more about why is it that 500 more Aboriginal women are murdered or missing in this country. Why did it take 35 years to bring what to most of us now know, a story about Annie Mae, what many people knew when she was murdered, that she was murdered by members of the American Indian Movement, and it was a secret that everybody knew, but nobody wanted to bring it to the family. Why does it take, why is Tanya Brooks's case unsolved? Why is it that, you know, our young girl, Hillary Bennett from Big Cove last year, why did it take so long for her as an Aboriginal young teenager to be found after she was kidnapped and raped and murdered? I think we need to find out why that is so that we can change that and maybe help save lives and women. And I think that the stories have to be told. I think the Sisters in Spirit campaign, which is to raise awareness about Aboriginal women and the plight and the problems they encounter, and the problems that the families encounter when they're trying to find answers to their missing family members, we have to find that out. And I think Annie Mae has inspired many people to, obviously we don't want to give our lives up for this, but to, you know, to be a voice and to speak out and not to accept what we've seen as injustices to women and Aboriginal people in the country. So I think we need to take a look at this Sisters in Spirit campaign. That's not the answer. It's just one of the things that was helping to bring awareness.
That was Kathy Martin, Mi'kmaq filmmaker. Here's Osinni, an Aboriginal women trio, which is in Bombsida's Music Spotlight this weekend. I played two cuts from her first album, Rattle and Drum, so now I'll move on to their second album, Listen. Here's Boil Water Advisory.
Boil water advisory. Yeah, boil water advisory. Boil water advisory. Boil water advisory.
Well, our brothers and our sisters, they've got the dirty, dirty water. They got no clean water to live. Oh no, they boil their water to cook in. They boil their water to bathe in. They can't even brush their teeth. Oh no, they're under boil water.
Source of life, and this must be made right. So many communities under advisory. Find the answer, please. Billion-dollar systems, few qualified bodies, operating facilities. Oh no, let's get some. Legislate quality. Our water's priority. They're under boil water. Advisory.
Advisory.
Source of life. And this must be made right. So many. Under advisory, find the answer, please.
Boil water advisory. Boil water advisory. Yeah, boil water advisory.
Advisory.
Oh, source of life, and this must be made right. So many communities under advisory. Find the answer, please.
The largest Mother Earth water walk wrapped up June 10th in Wisconsin. The walker stopped in Nipissing First Nation in late May, and Bomsida spoke with Anishinaabe grandmother Josephine Mandaman, who started it all.
The journey currently, we are doing the eastern water with the from the Abenaki land, which is in the Atlantic Ocean. That's our journey right now, but I've been doing other journeys, the south, the east, the west, and the north, but right now I'm just concentrating on the east, to getting it to the center of the lakes, the Great Lakes, which is Lake Superior.
And then what are you going to do there?
We will be putting all the four ocean waters that have been coming, but converging into the center from the four directions with the salt water. We'll be putting it into the fresh water of Lake Superior.
And why did you begin this journey?
Why? Mm-hmm. Well, this journey is part of other journeys that we've been working with the water. In the beginning was Lake Superior, which is the fresh water, and then out to the ocean. And then we realized that the salt water also has a healing potential, healing elements that is required for salt. Salt is healing, so we are. That's the idea of bringing that salt water to the Lake Superior. Not only Lake Superior, but the five Great Lakes, it'll be intermingled with that.
And when I listen to you talk, it also sounds like this is a very spiritual journey.
It is, of course. That's the main thing, is that everything that we do is spiritual. It's not anything it's not material in any way. It's spiritual. It's not about us. It's not about the water walkers. It's about the water that we carry, that is very special, very spiritual. So we have to keep in mind that we always think about the water first when we walk, when we talk to that water. We don't interfere with people's feelings. If they feel bad, it's really up to them to understand that what they're feeling is not good to be around that water, because that water can hear what you're feeling, can hear what you're saying. So we're very, I try to tell people, this is about the water, it's not about us, it's about that water that we took out of that beautiful ocean that we did the send-off ceremony.
And so you have to keep a good mind while you're carrying the water.
Always keep in balance. I always say, you have to keep balance. Always, don't let any kind of negative emotions come into this journey. But, as humans, there's always conflict. So we always try to say that, keep in balance and use common sense, in what you do.
Yeah. I've been following the water walk online and also on Facebook, and a lot of people are really supportive of Facebook or the water walk on Facebook. And I have friends, on the East Coast and in the States, and everyone. So every time people are going through, they're announcing it. They're coming through. We need donations stuff like that. And so, how have you felt about the support on your journey and people's reception?
Well, I've not experienced anything negative this time around. Because it's been very, very, people just coming to us and really, really giving us, thumbs up and honking their horns. And people, wanting to know what's going on. People pop in on us through their cars, and they stop us on the road to know what's going on. So we have brochures, we have little informations to give away for them to really know what they're doing. And they're saying that we're doing a good thing, that they really need to understand. People need to understand how they can protect their waters. And also to try to tell them to speak to the powers that be, which is their MPPs, House of Commons, to go and talk to the people there, the powers that are able to put policies in place to protect the water. It has to be done somehow, some way. And the grassroots people are the strongest people. The voices in numbers are very strong. And I hope to tell the Prime Minister and the presidents that little voices can be very strong and in impacting a lot of voices, because we can topple the whole process if we really wanted to.
I think so, because there's more of us down here than there are up there.
Exactly. Just turn it over, turn that pyramid over, and then you can really do a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other things I want to know is if are you going to continue this next year and the year after, or are you hoping that others will pick that up?
Well, I'm as we speak, I know there are people who are doing their own water walks, which is something that I really appreciate them doing, protecting their own waters, adopting their own lakes, and doing their, you know, doing what they need to do in their own areas. So that is my hope, that when this is over, that I can just hear people doing what they're doing in their own communities, which, you know, I don't have to anymore.
That was Anishinaabe grandmother Josephine Mandaubin, co-organizer of the Mother Earth Water Walks. You've been listening to Bomsida with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bomsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bomseda.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bomseda.